You are currently listening to a rebroadcast here on FreethinkRadio.com.
We have a very special guest from Lima, Peru, Mr. Brian Forrester. He's an avid researcher and advisor. He's an author as well. Check out his books. He's into all kinds of stuff. His book is called The Brief History of the Inca. You can get that from here. I'll post the link in the front page. And, anyway, there it is, Mr. Forrester.
Ta-da!
Hello.
Hello.
How are we today?
How about you?
Good.
Lima's, it's nice. Sun's gone down. It's about, 21 degrees Celsius. Great.
Awesome.
Nice climate.
Yeah, I bet. Southern Hemisphere, so it's apparently just turning into winter then.
Yeah, so-called.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, Brian knows about cold winters, though. He spent a lot of his teenage years in Western Canada, so he's used to harsher climates.
That's true, but not as harsh as Ontario, though.
Oof. Oh, out here we got a bad in the wintertime. Winter's real winter. Igloos and lumberjacks, log cabins. Anyway. We can get on with it. We're going to talk today a little about South American Polynesian culture, and then we're going to go into something more specific at the end of the show. If you guys want to click your live stream at the bottom, he's got a lot of pictures, so we're just going to kind of explain them as we go along.
So you're in Peru tonight, Brian?
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty far from Canada.
Yeah, it is.
Half a world away.
It is. It's a real pain in the ass to fly back to Canada from here, I'll tell you. It's a long, long trip.
Does your water go the other way?
Actually, it does, and the sun goes... I just noticed today in the last week the sun goes backwards.
Oh, yeah, I guess it would, eh?
Yeah, so it's kind of... I was visiting with my wife. We were visiting her father, who lives up in the highlands, and I noticed the sun was tracking literally backwards. It's like, what the? You know, I thought the world had suddenly changed, but I guess that's just the way it works down here. Amazing after 5 years of what you flew into after a while. Yeah, this is my cartoon. This is my cartoon picture. It's the most talked about picture that's in my book, and I put it in. You know, I think Canadian humor is kind of similar to English humor in that I put it in the book as more of a joke than anything, because this is, you know, this shows like the ultimate example of what the Inca looked like, which has nothing to do with what the Inca looked like at all. But this is a painting that is actually done by a Peruvian painter. So it shows them as being superhuman when in fact they were human.
It looks straight out of the pages of like heavy metal magazine
exactly.
Or something.
No, exactly. But you know, the description or the painting is a description of, you know, the fact that the first Inca supposedly rose out of the waters of Lake Titicaca, and that's in the oral tradition. That is, you know, that's poetry. What it means is that the Inca came from Lake Titicaca, but the painter decided to make it, you know, to take the whole story literally, and so he shows them on this hunk of rock and, you know, climbing out of the waves kind of thing. So, again, I put that in as a joke more than anything else.
You'll have to excuse us, guys. Brian has planes flying overhead quite frequently, so we will have to pause for that.
Good.
Yeah. I am in the flight path.
Right. I'll move to the next picture here. The Gate of the Sun. I believe.
Yeah, we did change. There must be a...
There is a bit of a delay.
Oh, yeah.
What are we looking at here?
Okay, that is the famous Sun Gate at Tiwanaku, which is in Bolivia on the south, the southern shore of Lake Titicaca. But what I found out, it's the most famous, you know, whenever you look up on the internet or in a book or anything, Tiwanaku, you'll see this. But the thing that I found out when I was there is that this isn't actually from, it's not from Tiwanaku, it's actually from Pumapunku, which is right next door to Tiwanaku. And Pumapunku is much, much older. It's thousands of years older than Tiwanaku is. And maybe the most mysterious place on Earth, because it shows obvious signs of machine tool marks. And that's something that I was able to talk with Chris Dunn about, because I met him just after he'd come back from back to Lima from Pumapunku. You know, the man's an engineer, and I just said, what do you think, Chris? And he said, he just shook his head. He couldn't figure it out. Because it literally looks like these people used, you know, like routers and things like that in order to cut the stone. And he had a, he's a, you know, he works with precision measuring instruments, and he took a tool that can measure the radius of a flat surface by 12 inches, and he's able to figure out how much of a variation from a purely flat surface there is, and he figured it was 1/50,000th of an inch. So you can't do that with stone, you know, stone hammers and bronze chisels.
No. Or chicken bones and obsidian.
That would take specialty tools to do that today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is like, yeah, it literally looks like machine marks, you know, like machining tools for flattening the, you know, the top of a engine or something like that. And then this picture, this is one of the most famous, you know, blocks. The stone is supposedly diorite, which is very hard, but it's not, you know, some people say, especially on Ancient Aliens, they say the only thing harder is diamond, which isn't true, but it's, you know, it's at least as hard as granite is. And you see this channel, that's why I was talking about a router. It looks like a channel went straight down, was cut straight down through it. And then people say, well, they would have used sandpaper, and it's like, no, I'm a sculptor, so it's like I stared as close as I could to this, and you don't see any marks whatsoever. And those holes are drill holes. They're not some guy with a piece of wood and some sand on the end. It's like those are drill bits that did that.
Rebar work.
That's what it reminds me of too. That's another thing about this particular stone, though, is that gap that's cut into it doesn't deviate. The same width that it is at the top, it is at the body. Like, it's simply, it may deviate, but the deviation is so precise, so minute, that it doesn't make a difference.
No.
Also, a lot of these stones are really They're smooth too, right? They're almost like they've been benchified.
Well, they are. They're not only that, but if you go to somebody's fancy house and you go into their kitchen and they've got a granite countertop, it's exactly like that.
Okay,
exactly. These are polished surfaces and perfect 90-degree angles. You know, it's a weird place, and the thing that's strangest about it is that Tiwanaku is, it's a tourist destination, and next door to it is Pumapunku, and it's behind this ugly barbed wire fence like a prison camp. So I think, you know, if you want to get into conspiracy theories or whatever, I don't think the Bolivian government is comfortable with Pumapunku at all, because it just doesn't, nobody can explain what the hell it is, so they'd rather that you go to Tiwanaku and go to the museum.
It looks more like a site than a quarry to me. Looking at it, it looks like an older site. It doesn't look like the quarry we're told it is.
With Pumapunku, though, it's hard to explain, because there was never buildings there. It's just all scattered willy-nilly, you know what I mean? Just here and there, huge. Obviously, effort was put into these things, but maybe it was the building ground to take to other places, or I don't know.
Well, actually, if you look at the picture that's on there now, that's a German, you know, schematic drawing that was done, and those are the pieces from that place. So you see how these things interlock with each other.
Yeah.
And not only that, when I was talking to Chris Dunn, I said, "Well, gee, it's amazing, these things would just fit together." And he said, "No, Brian, it's much more complicated than that. What it was is that they can only fit like a dovetail joint. They have to slide. They can only slide together one way and then lock. It's not like they just fit together and can come apart." And he just, you know, the man, he couldn't explain it. So how could I? But it's, you know, if you want to talk about one site on Earth that looks like some incredible civilization was here, or that maybe aliens were here, this is the place, because it's, you know, it's just, I've been to Chichen Itza and a lot of places, but this place is just off the chart. And they theorized that actually there was one giant building, but that some kind of explosion, possibly a meteorite about 13,000 years ago, hit close by, and there was a sonic boom went right through the stone, and that's what caused the stone to explode. But yeah, if you ever get a chance, it's actually kind of difficult to get to. But anybody who's interested in ancient megalithic sites, Bumapunku at least is number one on my list. I haven't been to Egypt yet, but Bumapunku for South America, I think, is the one.
No doubt. No doubt. You got a new slide up there.
Oh yeah. Okay. So this is what the Inca are thought to have looked like, according to the Spanish. And the thing is that, you know, if you ever go to Cusco, you'll see paintings like this all over the place, because this is actually the way the Spanish decided to portray the Inca. The Inca didn't look like this.
Yeah.
The Inca men did not have long hair. They had really short hair. And supposedly the reason behind that was because they had elongated heads. But the King of Spain, I think it was King Philip, when they were, basically taking over what was left of the Inca civilization, he said, "I want you to paint me, you know, some very fancy pictures of what the Inca looked like, but they don't actually have to look like the Inca. I just want some fancy paintings for my palace." And so this is what he got. And so ever since then, this has been the portrayal of the Inca, but it's not what the Inca looked like.
Right, they had the short hair to show the prominence of the elongated head, right?
Yeah, exactly, and it's possible that they had red hair, too.
Yeah, we were talking about that, we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, but I just wanted to show that because that's, the thing about if you go to Cusco, in general, most of the tour guides there, either on purpose or by accident, are not well educated as they could be. And you would think that the so-called descendants of the Inca would be the experts, but unfortunately that's not the way it is. And that's why I decided to set up my little tour company, is because I learned a lot of the oral stuff from local people. And when I saw the way that, 95% of the tourists in who visit Cusco were being educated, I got very basically pissed off and thought, well, I think I can do a better job than this. And, it's a far more intriguing story than what most tourists
Right. When you go on the tour, you probably generally would get the textbook explanation of everything, right?
Well, that's it. What you do is you get the textbook Western interpretation. So you even have these Peruvian, native Peruvians walking around with a textbook written by a professor from the United States, and they won't tell you anything about the oral tradition. And the picture that's on now shows you, that's from the 1600s. So if you look at that guy's head, that's supposed to be an Inca, that shows that he had short hair. And you can maybe interpret a bit of an elongated skull, but, maybe not. But that, at least that shows, that's a more realistic portrayal from the 1600s.
Yeah, it would seem to me that they, because, I don't know, they do that to it's a stereotype, you know what I mean? They want certain things a certain way. They want to make the public feel a certain way about these people.
Right.
Without a certain image of them.
Right, yeah. When they write home and call them savages, they want people to believe it. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Now that's it. But then what they also do is they say that everything was made by the Inca, and which is also untrue, because all of the structures that are really, you know, the ones where they talk about you can't fit a human hair or a piece of paper in between, that is, all those ones are most likely, you know, left over from another culture that existed probably 12,000 years ago. And the Inca, when they got into Cusco, you know, basically said, wow, nice buildings, why don't we live there? You know, they adopted them rather than necessarily built them. And so the picture that shows here is, that's the, I guess you'd call the interface between one of the ancient so-called Inca buildings on the right, and then on the left is the reconstruction done by the Spanish. So the Spanish basically ripped Inca buildings apart and then rebuilt them.
Using mortar.
Using tons of mortar. Any Mason would be embarrassed with the way the Spanish rebuilt Cusco, because sometimes the mortar is at least half an inch thick. And that's why during earthquakes the Spanish parts fall down and the Inca stuff still stands. The actual running joke in Inca is that, you know, the Inca buildings were made by the Inca, the Spanish buildings were made by the Incapables. A little play on words. But yeah, this building is called the Coricancha, and it's an absolute masterpiece. And in 1950, this giant church that was built over top of it during an earthquake, the whole thing fell down. And the Inca Foundation was standing there, you know, didn't move even a millimeter. And so luckily the town fathers and mothers of Cusco said, you're not rebuilding the church. You know, this is Inca.
Now, is there any idea as to what these little nubs are in the rock? Like, you see them, even there's some stone in Egypt that has the same pattern, the same little nub that comes out.
Exactly.
Yeah, stones worldwide with that.
Yeah, I've heard two theories. One of them is that the knobs were left there because it was part of a solar calendar. So as the sun tracked against the sky, the different knobs would cast shadows, and they would interact with each other, making patterns that we can't figure out. Another theory, more like indigenous kind of theory, is that those knobs were for collecting solar energy to energize the building in some kind of way. And the conventional archaeology view is that those knobs are there so that the Inca could wrap a rope underneath them and the knobs would help them to lift the stones into place. But my argument against that has always been, well, since the Inca were into, you know, perfection, they would have knocked the knobs off, and archaeologists say, no, it's not true. But it just goes to show, you know, it's just, I don't like to trash archaeology, but when they come up with really nonsensical statements, I go after them.
Well, it's a very controlled field, too.
Very, very.
Yeah, and these stones aren't light, either. I mean,
oh no.
Let's face it, hemp rope, and I've seen the documentaries where they try to recreate that. It doesn't work. They fall apart and they end up using nylon, or they end up using steel pulleys, and they end up, you know, it just, the way they say it works never works. We still can't do it.
Exactly. Well, the funniest thing is that there was a documentary done, I think, about 10 years ago, and these guys were determined that they were going to make part of an Inca wall with stone hammers and bronze chisels, and they were slaving away for like 3 or 4 days. And because the film crew said, you know, you guys have to speed up, they had to use power tools. You know, so
right.
It's like, come on.
Even the ones that you see on TV where they move this huge megalithic block like 4 feet and it takes them 6 hours, they consider it like a huge victory. Like, yeah, that must have been the way they done it. But it didn't take the ancients hundreds of years to build these things.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, they weren't there, and then they were there.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
and
they went
like, well, like, actually, in this building in particular, this one, they say this was the first one built in Cusco. And this, you know, this, like, the Inca arrived from supposedly Tiwanaku, and then they supposedly decided to build this giant perfect building, and they went 60 kilometers to get the stone. Well, that doesn't make sense, you know, a hell of a lot of sense to me, that they would go that distance just for building material when all of Cusco is made out of, you know, there's stone all over the place. But the special thing with this stone is that it's basalt, which has a lot of iron content. And so, you know, iron conducts electricity.
Right.
So again, whoever the builders were, and I don't think, you know, I don't think it was the Inca, because the other half of the oral traditions say that the Inca occupied this building for 200 years. So, you know, either they built it or they simply occupied it. I'm more of the school of thought that they found it, they lived in it, and then they decided to start building Cusco after that.
And with those materials, it almost suggests that someone knew something about the magnetism of the earth and the ley lines. And
exactly.
So,
yeah, because actually the whole ley line structure of the Inca civilization starts in the center of this building.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're called seques, and they radiate out from there, like hundreds of miles. But it's the core; it's the absolute core of this building that is the center of it.
And they these particular stones that we're looking at now, they use molten bronze. Is that the theory here, to lock stones together?
Yeah, I don't know if I included a picture of that or not, but that's one thing that supposedly is the same in Egypt and Peru and Tiwanaku, is that they use bronze clasps to hold the stones together. And you know, the basic idea is, well, that would, you know, if an earthquake happened, that would hold the stones from moving. But I think a better theory is, if we get back to the idea of electromagnetics and energy, is the fact that the bronze clasps would connect each one stone to the next, to the next, to the next. So it would almost create like a line or a parallel line of batteries for some reason. At least that's, you know, that's another theory.
And then you can get into the Egyptian light bulb and...
Exactly. Now the whole thing, yeah, all that stuff.
Now, this one, obviously older building... Newer building built on top of older structure.
Is that the same one we're looking at? But anyway, moving along, right along. The left side of the building is... the thing is, what happened in Cusco, especially the little that remains of the Inca buildings, was that... the stones were either too big or they were too complicated in shape for the Spanish to easily take apart, and that's why they left them in place. So that's why this, in this picture still, the part that's on the right, that was a giant curved wall, and so for the Spanish to take that apart and try to reconstitute it into another, like another building, like with a flat wall, they couldn't do it because they'd have to reshape the basalt, and they didn't have the tools for it.
So,
yeah,
we're listening to Freethink Radio. We're talking to Mr. Brian Forrester out of Lima, Peru this evening. He's showing us a lot of slides, if we could get him back online. We were just talking about how the Inca, who are given credit for most of the buildings in and around Cusco, probably didn't build them. They were there when the Inca got there, so they just used them and adopted them and did what they needed to do. So by the time the Spanish got there, they already had Inca monuments all over them and everything else, so they just assumed that they were Inca, and to this day, that's what we go with.
Yeah, and actually another important point is the fact that, the whole history of the Inca was the fact that a lot of it is written from a very European kind of perspective, and the High Inca wasn't like a king in terms of somebody that controlled the people. He was more like in Native American societies, where the chief is actually responsible. So that's one way that they became successful in terms of expanding their civilization, was they didn't really conquer. What they did is they offered the adjoining, you know, little countries, they said, you know, we have this amazing road system, and we have all these, you know, skills.
Yeah.
If you join with us, since you have, you know, all these other materials and things and gold or whatever, you could use our road system. And so there were only actually three cultures that the Inca had to physically conquer. But the way most history has it written is that they were, you know, these warlike people who beat the shit out of everybody, and it's, you know, it's just not true. And that's what made the Inca successful, and their whole downfall was half of my book is about the conquest by the Spanish, and the Spanish themselves weren't necessarily brave or intelligent. They were just, in a lot of cases, or areas, they were simply lucky. There was actually a civil war going on at the time, and the Spanish under Pizarro simply took advantage of the situation at hand. And he cheated and lied. Oh, here we are. Okay.
Yeah, we're back up.
Are we?
Okay.
On this one, we can definitely see structure, different culture over top. Like, this is a different structure built over top of a more ancient structure.
Yeah. Well, actually, the thing is that what this shows is, you see that, you know, you see the perfect shining wall there. That's the original part. And then to the left-hand side below, that's reconstitution, probably done by the Inca themselves. And above that, you know, most people aren't going to believe it, but the sort of polygonal-shaped stones with the mortar in between, that's classic Inca, which most people don't, you know, won't believe, but it's true. The experts that I talked to in Cusco said that that's how the Inca built, especially the huge agricultural terrace system, which they were responsible for. But that's, you know, that's standard kind of Inca construction. The shining, you know, perfect wall is an example of what they found when they got to Cusco. And, you know, like anybody would adopt something like that. They wouldn't tear it down and say, let's start from nothing.
And this speaks to the Inca obviously tried as best as they could with the technology they had to duplicate what had already been there beforehand.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can see the skill level and obvious, in my interpretation anyway, the technology level was drastically different.
Exactly. Yeah, drastically different, because that wall is the best example maybe in the world of where you can't get a piece of paper or a human hair or a razor blade in between. Okay, this one's different. This is, this again is probably not Inca. This is pre-Inca, but it's different in terms of the fact that each one of the stones is a completely different shape. And, you know, the common explanation for that is, well, they'd find a stone and kind of shape it and stick it together. But what they don't tell you is, if you look at the stone that's right in the center there, that is the head of a snake. And if you look to the right, upper right area, that circle is the eye of the snake. And then to the right of that, you'll see a squiggly line. That's the snake's tongue. And then to the left of it is the snake's body. And so what it is this wall is a bunch of pictographs that have been put together on, you know, they did this on purpose, whoever they were. And the stone's called andesite. It's, again, it's at least as hard as granite, if not harder.
And again, there's the, if you look close, there's the little nubs.
Exactly. There are a lot of nubs on this one. And you can also see where some of the stone's flaking off, like its skin coming off.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be an example of vitrification. Where the surface was heated so much and probably quite fast that it made the surface unstable. And so over, you know, hundreds or thousands of years now from weathering, the surface is peeling off, almost like skin coming off.
Yeah. And that zigzag construction, just want to bring this up, is also found around the world. It's found in the Polynesian islands, the Indonesian islands. It's also found in Japan on the Emperor's Palace.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's something that I think it was my second or third trip to Cusco that a local person pointed the pointed these pictograms out to me, and it's like, holy shit, you know, when you see that, it's like, wow. Because, you know, you get programmed your first trip to Cusco that it's like, well, you know, different shaped blocks, they kind of put them together and they look, you know, good. But when you get into the idea that they're actually, you know, actually, picture puzzles, then it's like, my God, these people had, you know, a lot on their mind when they were building, not just aesthetics, not just making something strong, but something that told a story.
That's what I mean. That's not, science wants us to, general consensus wants us to believe that these ancient cultures were specialized in specific fields, and that's it. But this leads to a full mind being used. You know what I mean? It's not just worried about the masonry and the fundamentals of putting a 10-sided block in the middle of a, you know what I mean? Just the intricacies astounds.
Yeah. And this one does have, you can see little gaps that may have been earthquake damage. It's hard to tell, but a lot of them, again, you get the joinery is so perfect that, you know, you can't, you know, it's the only standard. You can't fit a piece of paper there.
And not a heck of a lot of mortar anyway, if there's any.
No, there's none. It's just, it's rock. Green, and it's green. Green andesite.
No, it's really beating up on my computer today.
Something's wrong. Maybe a lot of people around here would say that maybe someone doesn't want Brian's info getting out.
Well, too bad for them. It's going to get out anyway.
No doubt.
Well, I'll tell you this. We are recording the audio. So we can put the slides up to the audio even after the fact, even if we have problems with the video. So,
okay, great.
We will be archiving this and putting it on YouTube too. Well, there's the next slides back up again anyway.
Oh, there we go. Okay, yeah, okay. That's Sexy Woman, and I've heard from, or at least that's what it's called, and you know, people erroneously call it Sexy Woman, which is offensive to the people of Cusco, but anyway, I've heard that actually its traditional name is called Sacsa Uma, which means the head of the puma, and that's because the whole city of Cusco was designed in the shape of a puma, and so the northern part, which is the head, is where this huge structure is, and this is the most commonly shown, you know, on Ancient Aliens and other shows. They'll show you this one because these are the biggest blocks. I'm standing, you know, I'm 6 feet tall, so this one's about 18 feet. Theoretically, it's about 100 tons. People like Graham Hancock have gotten into trouble in the past by saying that some of the stones are bigger, and people have, you know, have trashed him and other people because of that. But it's like, you know, these are huge, huge pieces of stone. And Thor Heyerdahl theorized that it would take, from his work on Easter Island, he theorized it would take 15 people to move one, like one ton. So if this one's 100 tons, you know, you're talking 1,500 people to try to manipulate this thing into place. But again, this wall is like the one from the last slide in that it does form pictograms as well.
Not only move it into place, but to get it there.
Yeah.
They quarried it from somewhere else and brought it there.
Yeah, and made it fit perfectly with the ones that are next to it. Okay, this is called the Chincana, which is the Quechua, the language of the Inca. It's their word for tunnel. And it's actually very close to where Sacsa Uma or Sacsa Waman is. Most tourists never see it, though, because it's not on the tourist route. But it's about less than a quarter of a mile away. And what's neat about this is that you can see the sections that have been cut out of it like that. This stone is called andesite, which is very hard. And it's almost as though it's, you know, it was ancient Play-Doh or something, because it's so incredibly sculptured.
Right, how do you cut the back out of something like that?
Good question.
there's that other, I don't know if you have a picture of it in here, there's one where it's cut out like that, but the stone is laying in front. Nelson, you know the one I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah, the one that...
the stone that was cut out is out in front, and it...
Yeah. They, like, it's a square block, and they can tell by the grain of the stone where it fit into place, and it fits precisely into place.
Uh-huh.
Like, how do they do that? They, like, not even saw work. Like, it just came out of the wall somehow.
Yeah, and of course people say, well, maybe they had lasers, but, you know, laser, if they had lasers, it would melt the stone, and these are polished surfaces, and anywhere there's a 90 degree angle, it's never sharp, it's actually curved. And there are hundreds of examples. Jesus Gamara, who's the expert on these and lives in Cusco, you know, when he showed me this, I, you know, it's like, holy crow. And then I said, how many of these are there? And he said, around Cusco and the Sacred Valley of Peru, there are 5,000 of them.
Wow.
So, you know, so it's not like they made a few of them. They're all over the place.
See, the question I have, even if you were advanced builders and everything else, why would you go back and polish the quarry where you got the stone pillars from?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was on the Graham Hancock board with that one, and these two so-called archaeologists came on, and they kept calling every photograph I put up, they called a quarry, including this one. This is called Amaru Machai, which means the serpent's cave. And it's quite close by. It's about a mile away from the other one. But this is a cave called the Moon Cave. And it's in a, you know, carved inside of this giant stone, very similar to the last slide. But this thing, you could fit, like, at least 50 people inside of it. And if you look at the walls, you see how incredibly smooth they are.
Right. And I'm not sure if I'm seeing the picture. It almost looks like there's a spot to sit in the corner there.
Yeah, and there's actually a bigger one deeper into the cave. There's one that, you know, probably five people could lie on. And then there's a hole in the ceiling. And it's called the Temple of the Moon or the Moon Cave because supposedly it was, you know, special for the Inca priestesses would use it for different rituals, but again, it's something that was, you know, built long before the Inca showed up. The Inca adopted it and used it, but it's one of these things where, you know, just the amount of physical hours it would take to shape something like that is, you know, it's mind-boggling.
If this was already here, I got a question whether it was always rituals and, you know, all this, because, man, honestly, if I stumbled on a place like this, I would just kill it. You know what I mean? It wouldn't necessarily be somewhere I perform major, you know, blood rituals or sacrifices or anything. It'd just be a place to chill. You know what I mean?
Well, actually, that's a great point, because the thing is, they call everything, you know, anything that looks interesting, you ask a guide and they say it was for ceremonial purposes. And it's like, for God's sake, you know. I think the Inca actually had to take time to sleep and eat, you know, beyond meditate. You know, everything's meditational or ceremonial, and it's like,
And you hear a lot of disinformation about how when the Spanish got there, they were all, you know, killing virgins and blah, blah.
No, that's something that was completely made up by the Catholic Church in order to ridicule the descendants of the Incas and make them ashamed of their past, and that's an excellent way to convert someone to another belief system. Because if you destroy someone's belief system, then you destroy them, and that's exactly what the Europeans did, especially in the Americas, but all around the world. The first thing they did is attack the belief system by supposedly bringing Christianity to them, but it's a way to manipulate.
Right, well, when in reality, a lot of the bloodletting was done by the Christians that were there. They were cannibalistic themselves.
Yeah,
you know?
The whole history of the subjugation of the Americas by Europeans is, you know, is horrific. They supposedly either directly or indirectly, were responsible from the arrival of Columbus to today for the death of 50 million people.
Right. Well, another host here actually did a history on the Native people of North America and talked about how when the Spanish got here and where the Christians don't eat meat on Fridays comes from.
Was to
stop the cannibalism, because a lot of the soldiers or whatever, the people that were settling here, were eating the people. They go to the church, get it blessed, and then eat. You know what I mean? So that's a lot. A lot of the sinister was done by the side claiming that, you know, the other side was doing it.
Yeah, that hits close to home for Canada, because that's exactly what they did to any native that was on this soil anyway.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's true, but, you know, I think, you know, the British weren't nice, the French weren't nice, the Portuguese weren't nice. I think the Spanish were the worst.
Yeah.
I was just reading the story, you know. And,
the
and
Spanish came with the Vatican. That's why they were worse than anybody else.
Well, and, I wrote in my book, the thing is that the reason why these guys came and were the conquistadors was because life at home in Spain was completely miserable for them.
Yeah.
And by the time each of them got to the New World, they had to borrow money to get on the ship to go across the ocean. And so they had to make money in order to survive. And so that's why the whole thing was about getting the gold, was because especially Pizarro was so deeply in debt that he had no choice. He either had to find gold, or he was going to debtor's prison, or was going to be killed.
Yeah. So gold he found.
Boy. And this picture, this is one of the absolute masterpieces. This is in a side valley in the Sacred Valley. And for those who don't know where the Sacred Valley is, it's close to Cusco. But that's... It's called sacred because it's been an agricultural place for thousands of years, and most of the great Inca buildings are in the Sacred Valley. And this little place, this wall is just, you know, mind-boggling when you see it in person, because the first question that comes to mind is, why the hell was it made?
Yeah.
You know, with that much effort, it's life size. That door, I can stand inside that door, but it's like 7 feet by 14 feet. And the question is, why would they have bothered to go to the effort?
That's just kids' tags or whatever. That mark.
Yeah, yeah, that's graffiti.
Disrespect.
That's terrible.
And I'm a graffiti artist.
Okay.
but no, that's obviously a sacred site. That's obvious. Somebody, you know what I mean, put a lot of reverence into whatever was happening there.
Exactly.
It's just disrespectful.
Okay, this symbol is called the Chicana, and anybody who goes to Cusco in general, you know, anyone who goes to Cusco will see that, and it's the most popular pendant on a necklace. In fact, I'm wearing one right now, but people call it the Inca cross, but it predates the Inca by at least 3,000 years, and it's an incredibly complicated instrument, because it represents, at least in this example, it represents the four elements. On the right side, you see air, and then below it, fire, water, and earth. So, you know, the four elements are there. And then also the three levels of Inca spiritual consciousness are put onto it as well. The three animal symbols that show up all the time in Inca and earlier belief systems are the serpent, the puma, and the condor. The serpent represents the subconscious, the puma is the conscious, and the condor is the superconscious. And that's also where people like Carl Jung got his concept of...
I was just going to say that Sigmund Freud's ego, superego, it did.
Exactly. And you find that throughout a lot of cultures. The Hawaiians had the same thing. They had three levels of consciousness. and Jung talked about his archetypes, and he borrowed those concepts from indigenous cultures. But this Chicana symbol represents like just innumerable numbers of different meanings, depending upon which ones and which interpretation you're looking at. And the other neat thing about it is you see the line that's going through at a diagonal, and at the top it'll say Ruta Viracocha. Well, what that is there are all these theories and stories about this tunnel system that runs underneath Peru. Here it is.
I just want to break in here. Does this not look a little bit like the Mandela at Nazca, Nelson?
Yeah. Oh, actually.
I'd have to look at it again, but...
Yeah, I'll get that picture up again.
Because I'm pretty sure it almost looks the same. Which is that picture we were talking about before we got on air, the huge mandala on the Nazca lines, if that's the same thing.
This symbol is at least 3,000, maybe 5,000 years old, but you know, again, it's the reason why I put it up is that people are told it's the Inca cross, and so they think the Inca invented it, but what the Inca were great at was either borrowing or inheriting from other cultures. And so the cool thing about the line that you see stretching from the southeast to the northwest is that on that line is where a lot of the most sacred sites are. You see Tiwanaku's there, this place called Pucara's there, Cusco's there, Machu Picchu's there, and Cajamarca's there. And it's also in the oral traditions. It says that, this great teacher from ancient times came who was called Viracocha, it's Viracochan. He taught the people the arts of civilization, and then he disappeared into the ocean, he disappeared on a boat and sailed. And so this is supposedly his path. By the time he got to the ocean, he got on board some kind of ship and disappeared off into the horizon somewhere.
Go on, next slide.
Yeah. Okay. Should be popping up any second now.
Yeah, I just gotta get used to the delay. Don't have any more tech difficulties. Yeah, I pulled up that picture, and it's quite close anyway.
Yeah, I thought so.
Okay. Oh, here we go. Okay, this is at Ollantaytambo, where you want to go. And Ollantaytambo gets about 10% of the, or not that, probably 20% of the visitors that Machu Picchu gets, but the train actually leaves from about an eighth of a mile from where this photograph is taken. And I think Ollantaytambo is at least as interesting, if not more interesting, than Machu Picchu. This wall is probably what's left of the Sun Temple, and the color's terrible, but it is pink granite, which, of course, is a material that you find a lot of in pre-dynastic Egypt. They built a lot of stuff out of pink granite, supposedly because of the high crystal content, because they were using it for, some kind of
residation. Yeah. It always comes back to residation. I've noticed that lately. Even, I don't know if you've looked into anything about Ed Lead Scanlan's work.
Yeah.
Because
coral contains a lot of quartz, which is crystal, so it can resonate very well.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It always comes back to frequency and resonation to me.
Cymatics, man, get it. A lot of work on that. Explain. A lot more research has to be done, but they've done stuff like that. They've done lots of things. What's weird about this particular wall is those are like where the lines are stones.
Yeah.
That's not carved into the wall. That's separate. And apparently it's earthquake-proof if you build them that way.
Yeah, that's the thing is that these, I think they average about 40 tons, these things, and they were brought up several hundred feet. And the lines in between, they're actually a series of shims that go vertically. And so the theory is that when there'd be an earthquake, the shims could move freely up and down, absorbing the shock, keeping the wall from moving, because the wall was set to such precision for alignment to the sun and other things that It wasn't allowed to move.
Correct.
And this is me with the Ancient Aliens crew, still at Ollantaytambo, and this is another, you know, cut-out stone feature that most people don't even see. But again, this has got, like, a lot of really big knobs sticking out of it.
Yeah, I see that. I was just looking.
And the main theory behind this one, again, is that it acted like a solar calendar. Where my hand is, there's a notch, and so at noon on the summer and winter solstice, the sun would be straight overhead and would shoot a shadow right down and would fit right inside that notch, you know, okay. Telling them that, you know, that was the day. But I bet it's more complicated than that. It's a lot of work just to make a, you know,
a calendar. Yeah.
Yeah. To tell you when the solstice is.
A sundial.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a pretty fancy sundial.
Now, I noticed in your videos, too, another thing, when lifting this rock, even you in your videos, when you're talking, you can tell the air is thin. You're up high. It's hard to catch your breath sometimes, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, Cusco is about 12,500 feet. And Lake Titicaca is about 13,500, so, you know, it's over 2 miles. And you go from Lima, which is at sea level, to Cusco in an hour. So your body suddenly goes 2 miles in the air, and everybody is affected by it.
You're right. It's a testament to how hard it would be to raise and quarry all this rock that high in the mountains, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
And that's it. The exertion put on your body plus the thin air and the, you know, wow.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And the stone for that, the stone for the big wall, that was from across the river, you know, miles down the river, the side of a mountain. So, again, you know, it's an obvious sign of, like, what you were saying about resonance. They selected stone specifically for its, you know, for what it was composed of, not just because it was kicking around, you know, something kicking around. They had to choose it. Like, supposedly, some of the stone in Egypt from Aswan was moved 500 miles because they wanted the properties in the stone.
Over mountain ranges.
Oh, yeah. It's just, you know, amazing. So this is actually, you know, when you go, you'll love Ollantaytambo. And, if you get a chance, I'd love to be your guide. But this is still at Ollantaytambo. But this is the mountain on the other side. And this picture is... I like to show this picture first because on the right-hand side, you'll see this huge building that's, you know, built more than 1,000 feet up from the valley. On the very left-hand side, there's a temple, again. And then in the center, you can't see from this picture, but hopefully the next one will show you what that thing is.
Yeah. That looks out of place, that's for sure.
It's a 400-foot tall head.
Oh, I can see that. Oh, yeah. I can totally see it.
And the neat thing is, if you're into, you know, ancient alien stuff or whatever, yeah. the more I look at it, the more it looks, you know, kind of reptilian, because you can see where the eye is, but in the eye, the eye pupil is vertical. It's a vertical slit, just like a cat or a reptile has, and in the mouth it's got one fang. And most people think it's natural, but I don't think so.
We'll get the post for that.
It should be up now.
It ain't up for me.
Yeah, not yet.
No, I couldn't do that thing again, did it? Right at a good part.
And it's like doing it at like every fifth picture.
But there have been found that ancient cultures around the world were known for doing that sort of Rushmore-esque, you know, part of the mountain sculpture.
Yeah.
Donna features the woman in West Africa, like a full almost shape of, like, you can totally tell. Once it gets pointed out to you, you can totally see it.
Like, yeah,
from waist up of a woman and a face and hair and everything.
Yeah, I saw that. That's quite incredible.
And it's crazy high on the mountain, too. It's like 300 feet up, a solid rock face, and then the sculpture starts. There, we got the close-up
Okay, well, the neat thing about this one is the bottom of it, the actual bottom of the face is 1,000 feet above the valley floor. So most of the tour guides say, well, you know, the local people did this, and it's like, really? They had, you know, ladders that were 1,000 feet tall? Because it's a vertical face. But here you can see the fang that's in the mouth. And then you can, at least to my mind, you can see the vertical slit in the eye. And what a lot of people say is that his chin is a beard, because this is supposed to, again, be a Viracocha, but, you know, the creator is represented.
He even got sideburns.
Yeah, he does. And some people think that either his nose fell off or there wasn't a nose. It's hard to tell, but once you see this thing, you can't ever look at it again.
The no nose gives it that reptilian aspect, though.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is along the same kind of theme. This of course, is Machu Picchu, and the big mountain in behind is called Huayna Picchu. And if you talk to old people in the area, they say that that is the shape of a human head looking upwards. And so this is actually from National Geographic. They did a story on it, and that kind of shows you the outline. It's not the right angle. If you get the right angle and the right time of year, it looks a lot more like a face than this does.
That seems a little bearded to me, too.
Also, again, a reoccurring theme, you have, like, all sorts of mountain man myths, like Sleeping Man's Man Mountain and stuff like that, right?
Giant of the Hill or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's a lot of that in Polynesia.
Machu Picchu itself is just a majestic sight, especially I've never seen that angle before.
Okay, yeah, this is at Machu Picchu too, and this is the Temple of the Sun there. And the thing is, you know, again, this gets into the whole idea that Machu Picchu, you know, they tell you that this one Inca decided to have it built in the 14th century, and it, you know, took like 50,000 people, and they built it. But what this shows you is that Machu Picchu itself also was built over different periods of time. This building is technically, you know, beautiful in terms of the stones being very close to each other. And they're, you know, the whole thing is the big theory is that there were three different civilizations. There was one called the Hanan Pacha, the second called the Uran Pacha, and the third one were the Inca. And the Hanan Pacha were the first ones. And what they did is they sculpted monoliths straight out of bedrock. And so inside this round building, you see the bedrock there, and that has been shaped. And so the idea is that a later culture came and they saw that whoever these master builders were, you know, did something that was amazing. So they built this protective wall around it. And then the Inca would build, you know, they wouldn't touch it. They would build into that as well. So 90% of Machu Picchu looks like it was built by the Inca. But the really special places like this and also the hitching post of the sun, they're, you know, at least 10,000 years old. They're much, much older than Inca construction.
And again, you know, a lot of cultures did that as well, built over, you know, ancient sites that they considered to be from their ancestors. And there's just so many reoccurrences globally, and that's another thing we were talking about before the show, how it seemed a lot of this, and the timeline of the 12,000 years, and, you know, a lot of this just leads to a global sort of thing going on that we're not really privy to the information of.
Yeah, but all the information is starting to leak out, which is great. You know, I love it. So this is the approach to the hitching, you know, the famous hitching post of the sun. It's the most famous thing. And what most people don't understand about that, you know, it's right in the center of the picture. Most people are told this is a single piece of stone, but what they're not told is that it's actually the top of the mountain. For some reason, it was important that that was made from the top of the peak itself. It had to be, you know, anchored as the mountain itself. And it's, you know, it's like just a masterpiece of sculpture. And again, you see the buildings around it, you know, very, very well put together.
Yeah. I'm just going to jump in and say, guys, you're listening to freethinkradio.com. This is the True North Hour. We're going into the second hour here with Brian Forrester, who's in Peru, actually doing Hidden Inca tours, which is more, from the description I got from the website, Brian, it's more like you doing your research and bringing people along to check it out with you.
Exactly. Well, exactly, because my wife and I do basically one tour a month for a week, and that's about all I want to do, because if you do it too often, you know, these incredible sites start to become boring, which you don't want.
You don't want it to be work.
Yeah, you don't want it to become like a job.
Yeah, so that's why we... Exactly. And that's, you know, if I don't discover something new, then... You know, I would get very depressed, but every time I do, and often it's because the visitors that we bring with us will point things out that we haven't seen and say, well, why does that look like a human head? And it's, what are you talking about? Oh, my God. You know, you found something.
Yeah.
So this again is the Hitching Post of the Sun, and it shows, you know, one of the basic aspects of it, and that's that each one of the corners points to a specific mountain, and each one of those mountains is strategically one of the four cardinal directions. And what isn't told is that on each one of those four mountains there is a hitching post of the sun.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So...
So not only did they build this one, they built three more just like it?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, there's one on top of the mountain in the background. That's Huayna Picchu.
And that is the mountain, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
That wasn't brought there. That wasn't built and put there. That was perfect. Molded from the top of the mountain. So
exactly.
That's the very peak, the top of that, whatever.
Now this is an incredible picture coming up here.
Well, and also if you want to get into the concept of resonance, you know, this stone is, again, high in quartz, and the whole substrate of Machu Picchu is serpentine, which has another different kind of resonance. This is actually what you view from the top of that mountain. This is this is looking down on Machu Picchu.
Wow.
Man, I'm so jealous. I'm so jealous. You know, now that you've told me that, you have no idea.
And that wasn't slopped together in 25 years by 50,000 people.
No, the thing is that it also represents the shape of a giant condor, and the upper right part is the head facing west, and the rest of it is the body of a condor spread out. So
it's just amazing. I can imagine the feeling standing at that spot looking down.
Actually, you can't imagine. You have to be there. Go ahead.
I was just going to say other ancient cities are laid out. Well, you said the condor, the cougar, and the serpent, right? And Cusco's laid out like a puma.
Yeah.
And Machu Picchu's laid out like a condor. I was just wondering if there was a serpent city as well.
Oh, no. Actually, the thing is, Machu Picchu, this is one angle of it. If you look at it from another angle, you see a serpent, and then from a different angle, you see a puma. So it's all perspective.
But
symbolically, this is the highest point, so you're looking at the highest animal being the condor flying. But from lower levels, you see the other animals. You know, why they would bother with this kind of stuff? Tough enough to build a city on top of a mountain and not put symbolism into the damn thing, too. This is an absolute masterpiece. This is halfway down that mountain on the backside, and about two people out of 1,000 see it. This is called the Temple of the Moon, and you can see how it's built, like, right into this natural cave. That's what makes it mind-blowing.
Yeah. Like the ceiling.
Yeah, the ceiling.
What gets me is, what's with the doors to nowhere? Are they considered portals? Are they considered what?
Yeah, I bet you there's a theory on that.
Yeah, well, there is a theory that they are, you know, like some of them were stargates, maybe. Other theories are that that's where the mummies of the Inca were kept, because the mummy the Inca were never buried. They were mummified and kept.
Okay. Right,
and so, so they would have to be moved around from time to time to make sure that, you know, the environmental conditions didn't get at them. And other, you know, other theories are gold objects were put in these places.
Okay.
But it's a, you know, I was lucky, you know, there you are, Machu Picchu gets 2,000 people a day at it, and I climbed down from ladders and stuff to get to this thing, and I was there by myself for about an hour with nobody. So, that to me is, that's special.
That photo also, whoever cut that rock in the center of the photo didn't build that stonework behind it.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is called a cheap plug for my book.
Plug away, man. Plug away.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. Well, it's available on Amazon and Lulu and also through my website as ebooks, and also through David Childress's Adventures Unlimited Press has has the real paper bound copies, and that's on the front page of my website has all that stuff on it.
And you're also working on another book. This is true.
Yeah, I've got three. I've got this book was my first. The second book is a history of Hawaii, and it covers Hawaii before Captain Cook, because almost every book about Hawaii covers the 2,000 years of Polynesian history in about 5 pages. And then the rest of it's about Captain Cook and plantations. And that really pissed me off. So thanks to Hawaiian elders, they taught me some stuff. And I wrote a book about where the Hawaiians came from, who they were, and how they lived. And then my third book is actually a guide to looking at these ancient structures of Cusco. And the book I'm working on now is with David Childress. It's about the elongated heads from around the world.
Which we're going to be getting into soon here. I think we're almost at the end of this package of pictures.
Okay.
But here's the next one. Hopefully it'll come up.
Okay. This is like there's a little museum in Cusco that shows you the theory of how the heads were bound. And what first tweaked me about the elongated head thing was that they show, you know, 5 or 6 examples of supposed Inca skulls that are not exactly normal looking. But this is, you know, this is their attempt at explaining how heads were elongated.
Yeah, with binding and whatnot, right.
Exactly.
And, yeah, this is the end of that, so I'm just going to shrink this down here, take a look real quick.
The skulls are a big mystery for me. I've done a lot of reading on how and why, and there are a lot of cultures that did indeed do skull binding to shape their, I guess, children's heads. But even they admit that they did it to make them look like these certain people who had heads.
Exactly. That's the whole thing. Is that the majority of the elongated heads, you know, were done artificially, but we found examples where they seemed to be natural, and that's what these cultures were talking about. They wanted to look like the ancestors. And so we found at least 3 examples of what the ancestors looked like from the, you know, from their skulls. And they're all found in Peru, the really big ones.
We're going to get a picture up or what?
Yeah, it's loading up the second package here.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I looked through this work a lot like that. There's two different, it seems to me anyway, that there's two different, like, there's the cone head, as some would call it, you know what I mean? The really long, pointed skull. And then there's the two lobes, sort of, with the dip in the middle.
Exactly.
Like the Star Child.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like the cone head kind of shape is much more common. But this, you know, this shows you right here. In the middle, you see the one that's like the two-lobed one. And then the two in behind are the elongated ones. And this is this picture is from the Paracas Museum, or actually the Ica Museum, which they have about 8 of them on display. And luckily, I was brought by one of the staff into the back room and into the warehouse, but in the back room they have at least 100 of them in boxes. But they don't have the money to research this stuff, which is sad. That's why I'm doing it. But yeah, the lobed one here in the front is more somewhat like what the Star Child seems to look like.
Yeah. And here comes another one.
Yeah, this is one of the really big ones. Yeah, so that's an X-ray of one, and the largest skulls in the world are from this area this little area I keep talking about on the coast of Peru called Paracas, which is south of Lima.
Yeah, I'd be wow, that's a really good picture. Even the jaw and the teeth look elongated.
Yeah, the jaw. That's a good point. The lower jaw is really big, and Klaus Donner talks about that too in his discussion. That it's the lower jaw is really massive compared to a standard human
and
being.
Prominent. It's
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and here's this is a cast of one of the great Paracas style heads. Supposedly, the volume of the skull is at least twice that of a normal human being.
But
the gravity and equilibrium would be completely different in order to support that head on a typical looking body. It would have to be the entire body would have to be misshapen.
The neck would have to be set out in front a little more.
Yeah, in order for balance to work, in order for that human, if that's what it was, to walk upright, it would have to be shaped differently.
Also, right. When we were talking to Amy Vickers about the Star Child skull, there was double the capacity, but also inside you could tell that the capacity had been filled. Now, is that the case with these? Like, does this create a bunch of space? You know what I mean? Between the brain and the walls of the head? Like, how does that work?
Well, nobody knows. That's the problem, because these these skulls are at least 2,000, if not 3,000 or more years old. So they were the process of mummification that these went through. It wasn't, it wasn't on purpose that they mummified them, but the sand that they bury these people into is so dry that, they naturally get desiccated. So, there's no brain material left. So the big debate is, were they just like big skulls with a normal brain, or were they big brains? Lloyd Pye thinks that their brains were huge.
Yeah.
Other people say no, so who knows? But, the one thing is supposedly you can't make the skull grow. And if this, if a skull like this has twice the brain or the bone volume of a normal head, then it can't be a normal human.
Yeah, it's DNA would have to be removed.
Exactly.
But obviously, also have
to be non-human.
Exactly.
But also, in the same token, it's not animal in the sense that it has cognitive learning and abstract thought.
Exactly, to walk upright.
Yeah.
This is one of the real ones. This is one of the three most famous and most ones in the world. Like if you go into Bing Images or Google Images and you type elongated skull, this one shows up at least probably one out of every 10 pictures. And it's again, it's an Ica. It's a Paracas skull. And unfortunately, you can't see in this picture, but this is where we start to get the giveaway where it's also not a normal human, because I'm sure you've heard the, you know, the idea that the main part of the skull has three plates. There's the parietal plate, or sorry, the frontal plate in the front, and then in the back there are the two parietal plates, left and right. And so you have three of them, but in the case of this one, it's only got two.
The suture is a lot finer where they join two on these, aren't they?
Exactly. That's the whole thing. The where the two parietal plates are supposed to meet, I couldn't even see a hairline fracture of where the suture could be.
So it looks like all one bone.
Yeah, it looks like that way. And also, again, you can't see on this one, but on the back of it is where the two holes are, where Lloyd thinks that that's right. Where nerves and blood came through as, you know, some kind of evolutionary or whatever, adaption.
Yeah.
To its, the fact it's so big.
Right, I noticed that on one of the videos I think I watched in the last week or so. It's like the holes and they're... So those were there prior, like they were already there. They weren't drilled in for science or anything, is what you're saying.
No, because the ones that I, you know, I got 10 DNA samples from five skulls from, you know, this guy who owns a private museum in Paracas. Because these ones, you know, these are in a government museum. They won't let you take them out. They won't let you look at them. They, you know, technically they won't let you photograph them, but I did. But, you know, this private museum director, I just said, would it be possible for me to take a DNA sample? And he said, oh, sure, go ahead. So I took my Dremel tool out and, you know, cut, you know, a little I didn't want to damage them too much, but I was able to get a sample out. And Lloyd got them out.
I did watch that on YouTube. By the way, anyone who's just search it in Brian Forrester on YouTube, you can check out a lot of his vids.
Yeah,
thanks.
Good stuff that very rarely see.
Yeah. I love how you put it into perspective in your vids, even though they're short little clips of here and there, almost as if you're along the tour and just turning the camera on when you come to something interesting. But it puts it into a perspective that you don't see in the documentaries. Like, you can see the whole layout of how everything looked. You know what I mean? And just mind-blowing, man.
Oh, thanks. Well, the thing is, Lloyd's got the samples now. He got them 2 days ago. So he's going to hand them to his the same geneticist that studied the Starchild skull, or team of them in Los Angeles, I think. They're going to study the samples I sent. So we'll find out if these guys are completely human and hopefully, you know, where their blood groups come from.
Right.
I don't want to make any predictions whatsoever. I just want to see what happens. But Lloyd's very excited. And, you know, I'm very thankful to Senior Juan Navarro of the Paracas Museum, you know, for allowing me to do this on his behalf. And please, anybody who decides to go to Nazca, go to Paracas, because it's a beautiful little town, and Senior Juan's got a nice little museum of priceless Inca stuff, and he only gets like 3 visitors a day. It's really a piss off. So, you know.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, and he's got 15 of these.
Day.
Yeah,
and he's got 15 of these on display.
Crazy. Well, I'll check it out if I ever go there.
Good.
Oh,
yeah. So, anybody who's interested in the elongated skull phenomenon, these three skulls are in the Ica Museum, which is in Peru, and they're the best examples of elongated skulls in the world. Even David Childress told me that when I was talking to him. He said, have you been to Ica? And I went, no. So he said, you know, you have to go and check them out. And, you know, any of the ancient aliens or von Daniken stuff, those are the skulls they always use as examples of what they call aliens. But no, you know, until we find out, nobody knows much about who they were. And the fact that they probably had red hair is kind of intriguing. They don't seem to have Indian.
Can we come back up yet?
Yeah, we got
but,
two.
But what's interesting about this one is if you all notice the holes. on top of its head. Do you know if that's what killed that thing, or did he live after that hole was made?
Actually, that's the whole key, is the fact that that is called trepanation, which is ancient brain surgery, which these Paracas people were supposedly experts at. The Nazca people were the culture that came after them, and we're not sure if the Paracas died out or what happened, but the Nazca went really crazy over trepanation. This example on the left, you can see that this person healed. There are a lot of Nazca ones where the skulls kind of healed to some degree, but didn't fully. And so, it's possible that what the Nazcas did was that they inherited or learned this technique, but they didn't master it, whereas the Paracas were the masters of it. And the skull underneath that little one that you just went past, that one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was from Ecuador, so it's not limited. This one's completely bizarre. This is a drawing made in the 19th century by a Peruvian researcher, I think called Tishudi, and this is supposed to be a fetus, which is hiding in the basement of one of the museums, probably the Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology in Lima, which I don't have access to, but I'm damn well going to at some point.
Yeah.
But he drew, this is supposed to be a specimen drawing of a real specimen, and that's obviously somebody who's got a very elongated skull for their, for their body.
That wasn't binded.
No, that's very, that's one of the most bizarre ones that there is.
Oh, yeah. No.
So bizarre in a respectful way.
Definitely bizarre. Okay, go to the next one.
Yep, we're going on.
When was that drawn?
I think 1870 something.
Really?
But it's in this giant book that's about museum artifacts, and it's strange, but it's by itself. Now this is also in the Ica Museum. The one in behind is a Paracas, elongated skull. The one in front is a Nazca skull. And the new theory that's going on, supposedly the Nazca were big at having so-called trophy skulls, in that they would drill a hole in the forehead and loop a rope in and then wear these skulls as trophies. But that's kind of the racist viewpoint.
Yeah.
The more modern view is that these individuals, whoever they were, because the Nazca were getting into deep trouble with their water because they defoliated their environment, maybe by accident, that individuals would actually present themselves to be sacrificed. And so that's what the so-called trophy head became, was a gift to the rain gods. So even the high priests who were the Paracas, theoretically, allowed themselves to be sacrificed for the good of the people. Or that's the story.
Yeah.
This picture was a really bad remake of what a so-called Inca grave looked like. It's in a museum, and it's a complete fabrication. The head, like the skull's neat, but I posted that on Facebook, and everybody just shot it down as being fake.
Yeah.
Or like it's a mock-up.
Yeah, I can see that. It looks.
But actually, also the reason I wanted to post that is that none of the real Inca, like none of the high Incas mummies have ever been found. The Spanish supposedly either burnt them or buried them or got rid of them. And so that's the unfortunate thing, is that we don't have actual Inca mummies to take DNA from in order to find out where they came from. This picture, it just goes to show, on the left you can see a normal shaped head in the back, like is faded in the background, and then the elongated head superimposed.
Again, the more prominent squared off and thicker jaw.
Exactly.
Yeah. And also, you'd notice that even the brain would have to be shaped differently.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
to fit inside a head. Like, the whole... And there's no bowl. There's no flat part of it for the brain to sit in.
Yeah.
What's stopping the brain from coming out the mouth? You know what I mean? No, seriously. Like, something's got to hold the brain in place. And that's why we have that flat part at the back of our heads. This doesn't have that. Just like the Star Child, it doesn't have that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
How does the brain stay in place?
Uh-huh.
That speaks to the non-human aspect of this thing as well.
Right, that's true. That's true. Yeah, and that's a lot, you know, that's a lot of bone manipulation.
Yeah, that's a really, like, binding, come on.
Oh, that would, you know, that, and, yeah, that would hurt. Okay, now this is the most bizarre one there is. It's a pretty big picture, but this is, like, completely odd. And I stumbled over this picture. It was actually just in a normal newspaper, not in the, you know, Star Weekly or something. But the cat, it was found about a year ago in the Sacred Valley outside Cusco. The police found this and some Inca pots that somebody was trying to sneak out of the country. But, you know, just look at the shape of that head.
Not only that, but look at the gold on his hands.
Yeah, on his fingernails.
Fingernails are gold, and it also looks to have a gold ring.
Oh, that could be. Wow, I haven't seen that. Yeah.
What's that?
Right. I can actually zoom in on it.
Is that a child?
Yeah, it's supposed to be 3 or 4 years old.
See, and no evidence of binding of any kind.
No, that's like something out of a science fiction film, to be honest.
Yeah,
but really? You know, what I was shocked was that it was just in a normal newspaper. It didn't say weird heads or strange alien. It just said Inca mummy found.
Wow. That is almost alarming.
I swear that's a ring on his hand. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I can see it.
That's something. It's something. And even the... The ribcage seems to go down way too far.
Uh-huh.
Farther than a normal person's ribcage.
Well, also
that's
for
the elbows, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and for a small child, the hands look pretty big.
As well as the head, the skull. It's
oh, yeah, large. Yeah. Now, this is, Olmec. You know, the Olmecs of Mexico who... David Childress just wrote a book on them because they're very mysterious, a very mysterious culture.
The Stoneheads.
They elongated their heads too. And according to David and many other researchers, the whole thing about the Mayans in 2012 was the Mayans inherited the calendar from these people, the Olmecs. So when
Maybe I'm racially conditioned, but does that not look Asian?
Oh, yeah, very much. Yeah, there's a lot of theory about that there was Asian influence as well, but the reason I put it up was because a lot of their sculpture, you'll see these, you know, elongated heads show up, and what David told me is that the World Authority on the Olmecs only mentions in his... in this great book he wrote about the Olmecs, he only mentions elongated skulls once. And if it was such a part of their culture, why doesn't he mention them more, you know, as being a common feature?
Another thing about the Olmecs is their pottery looks very Asian, as you can tell by this slide.
Yeah, this is Olmec
and
too.
The stone heads that they carved look very African.
That's true.
Which again, either of them two places are in South America.
Exactly.
Where the Olmecs are from.
Yeah, so here's the worldwide culture showing up, you know, this idea. That the, you know, the story is that the Pacific Ocean wasn't a barrier, it was a highway.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's another example of a Olmec portrayal of themselves. And like you said, the the very Asian looking eyes.
Yeah.
Just that,
even a lot of Indian cultures from North America consider like entertain the idea of at least of Oriental descent.
Uh-huh.
There have been Japanese, settlements found in Canada, in Western Canada, that date back to 600-700 years ago. Long before Columbus cabin.
Yeah, the whole thing about the Chinese, the Chinese had a major maritime, ocean going force, in the early 1400s. But this, of course, is going way back. And, because Paracas is on the coast, the major theory is that the Paracas people came from the highlands of Peru, which I don't believe, because anybody in general who lives on an ocean has a tendency of being a boat builder. So I think definitely the Paracas people had influence from some, other cultures. From maybe Egypt or, possibly from many different parts of the world, but we'll only find out, once we get the DNA analysis done.
And has the slide changed yet, guys?
Yeah, well, we got the two skulls.
Okay.
Does the orbital bone on them skulls not look very pronounced compared to that normal? Like, wouldn't you be able to see that with skin on top of it, like, jutting out?
Exactly.
I guess it would depend on the muscle structure around it, too, though.
You'd have to have a lot of skull muscle to fill that gap.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually...
But again, holding up that weight and the jaw...
It's true, because that head would need a lot of muscle to hold it up.
Well, it's true with the jaw that size, too, Nelson. You would almost need...
You get the bite through rock with a jaw that size.
Jesus.
Well, actually, maybe the jaw evolved to counterbalance the weight. But that's a good point. That's what Lloyd pointed out with the photos I took of the samples that I sent. He said, "Look, they must have had massive muscle to hold that thing in place because he could see the bone structure."
Right.
This picture shows you, that there are two bone plates.
There's no suture whatsoever there.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, there's not a hairline.
Right here.
A-shaped plate on the top of the head.
It should have another crack line right where my mouse is right now.
Exactly, and there's absolutely nothing. Not even a shadow. And I'm fortunate that, I've been able to handle some of these and, almost stick my nose up to them to look, because people say, well, there must be a suture. And it's like, there isn't one.
Yeah, and here's another.
Exactly, right. Yep, right there, exactly.
The other sutures are so pronounced, there'd be something.
You'd have to, it's as though the bone structure is totally different.
Again, the orbital bone sticks out quite a bit.
Yeah. And this is the, this is the depiction of how they think, the elongation was done. And I just find this picture kind of comical. Maybe some people did that, but
is that stone, that ring?
Yeah, it's supposed to be two stone rings with some kind of cord that was.
It'd be awfully uncomfortable. That's not like NASA space foam or nothing.
Yeah. Awfully uncomfortable.
The migraines that would ensue just on the bending of the head like that. You gotta think. That would cause some sort of pain and discomfort. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to do it until you're, like, a teenager.
Yeah, you would. A lot of them talk about 6 months, but you'd kill, you'd kill a baby trying to do that.
Holy shit. 6 months.
Come on, just a little bit more. Ow! So, yeah, that's just, this is the archaeologist's view. I don't think they found the artifacts to prove it, but this is what they want you to believe in 100% of the cases. And the picture on the left here it's again, it's just something I stumbled on. That's actually a mass burial in Peru, in Lima. And you see all the skulls there, but the one that's light colored is obviously an elongated head.
Yeah.
You know, just sitting there with a bunch of other ones in this generic photograph.
And also the one, there's one that's on top there. It looks like it was like more of the two lobe. There's one, I don't know, three heads in front of it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, God knows what's underneath the pile. But again, you know, I was just going through Bing images, and I think it said, you know, I was looking up, you know, Lima ancient burial or something, and this one popped up, and I thought, whoa, you know, because it's tough to find a lot of photographs of these. Like I say, the ones from the Ica Museum, even if you type in Russian elongated head, the Ica ones, you know, the Peru ones keep showing up all the time. So, and then the picture on the right, this is from the Nazca Museum. Again, showing that, you know, the elongated skulls were the Paracas people who lived in the Nazca area before the Nazca people showed up.
It also looks like they're trying to pass off one of those trophy skulls, too.
Yeah.
Kind of association methods, you know. Oh, it's with these, so.
Yeah. With the bandana and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with the, you know, it also goes along the basic theory of, well, okay, this place is called Nazca. Here are some Indians. These Indians must have always lived here. You know, they don't look deeper.
Yeah.
You know, to see that, you know, migration happens. In, you know, all over the world this happens. You know, there's always a turnover. You know, cultural turnovers, and that's what, you know, the study of any culture anywhere in the world will tell them to be pretty conservative with the way they approach things, but the real gold, you know, so to speak, is with oral traditions, because, you know, people will tell you their history, and their history is always a lot more interesting than the, you know, we dug up this plot and we found a hunk of pottery and, you know, we dated that and stamp, you know, they put a stamp on it.
Yeah.
And this one, I, you know, this one shows like an elongated skull in a mummified form, and again, the color is terrible, but the hair is kind of reddish in this one.
Right.
So I'm happy that what I did with I was able to take hair samples from the three of the skulls from Paracas, and I was also able to take the hair with the roots. Because the roots. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
And that particular skull that you were able to take the hair from had quite a red tinge to it from what I saw in the video.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, people will say, "Well, that was bleaching," but the key is going to be in the roots. If the color in the roots is red, that means the person had red hair.
Yeah.
So again, I'm thankful to the little Paracas Museum that he just, you know, let me, you know, pull these samples off. It was, you know, people are just, you know, I was happy that, you know, researchers I talked to, like David Childress and Lloyd, and people are going, "What? What are you talking about? You're able to get samples?" Yeah, why? Do you want some more? So, it's great.
These were naturally mummified, right?
Yeah, they were basically just desiccated because the environment is, Caracas gets about 1 inch of rain a year. So,
just dehydration.
Exactly. Anything buried in the sand is going to wind up naturally dehydrating. And this one, this is one of the mystery ones, the one on the right, because it was there at the Ica Museum about 5 months ago. And, you know, you can see it's got hair and skin.
So hair, might add.
Exactly. Good point. And when I went back last time with the Ancient Aliens crew, it was missing, and the museum wouldn't tell us where it was.
Oh, really?
Almost as though it's like, uh-oh, you know, we have to hide this.
Well, there seems to be a lot of tissue on there. You could test.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The one on the left, the little one,
uh-huh,
looks like it's been chopped right
at
the top of the head.
Yeah, exactly. Those are examples of the trepanation, and there's the lower ones in the center is an elongated one where they, you know, cut a huge part of the top of his head off, or her head off, and it grew back flat instead of being domed.
And in the background, that's the tools they use, is it?
Oh, that's the theory. You know, it's the old thing. You find him next to me and you go, tools.
Here, dig that ice pick out of the box there, and we'll throw that on display.
Yeah.
Well, it's just the old thing where, you know, the general public is so gullible when they go to museums, because automatically it's like these people have to be the experts.
It's implied truth, right? Just by walking in the door.
Yeah, you don't have to actually lie. Just subconsciously, you get the impression, oh, well, that's weird, honey. Look at that. It must use them tools.
Yeah. And here's one, you know, here's the sort of bum-shaped kind, you know, not the technical term, but that's the kind of, you know, what the hell is this? No, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that was manipulated, but the question is, why would you make that shape? You know, the theory is that it was only the kingly queen and priest classes that were elongated, because they thought, well, you know, bigger heads mean bigger brains, and the general public will see them and go, well, there's, you know, there's King so-and-so. But, you know, why this kind of shape? I leave that to you two guys to, you know, you tell me.
Yeah, that would be...
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the movie Little Nicky?
No.
It's an Adam Sandler movie, and the devil gets mad at somebody and puts boobs on his head.
It looks to me like they almost believed, by splitting the skull and trying to make two halves, that maybe they would, like, have two brains or something.
Like, they understood that there was two different lobes.
Right. And tried to separate.
They wanted to be able, to be able to work them independently. Like, sometimes
that's
brain, but if I choose to be, I can create two left brain.
Well, that's true. The funny thing is that in a lot of cultures, they didn't think that the brain actually did anything. You know, that a lot of cultures thought that the Greeks were the ones who thought that the brain was in the liver or something, and not the brain. So maybe these people were smarter. But this picture is ancient Mayan mummy. So you see some elongation, and that baby wasn't very happy with whatever happened to, you know, him or her.
No, it certainly wasn't. Is that short hair, or is that just coloration on the skull?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the preservation was different on these. But this, you know, this kind of goes to show maybe that the Mayans descended from the Olmec.
If you look at the middle one, it also has almost like looking at a picture of a Buddha, the chubby cheeks, the eyes, it's got the oriental feel, if you look.
Yeah, it's lotus position and whatnot.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, the one in the middle.
And they're definitely elongated. Like, that's what clinches it for me. When you find child heads that are already elongated.
Right.
You know what I mean? Then it's not deformation. It's not... skull
done over time, and
it can't be. It just doesn't make any sense. These people were born like that.
Uh huh. Well, that's
they
why
like that. Their brains developed like that.
Uh huh.
Whole different brain. Maybe they might be human or whatever, but we don't use 90% of our brain.
Right.
You know what I mean? Maybe they could, and that's how temples were built and pyramids and whatnot. I don't know.
Well, that could be, and that's another theory behind, that what the people who were trying to elongate the heads may be as a result of the fact that the actual elongated beings died off, and so maybe it was a desperate attempt to try to get that brain function so that, you know, they could continue with whatever superpowers these people have, whether it was psychic power or whatever.
Well, guys, we're coming to the end of the hour. I want to thank you, Brian, for coming on the show. Yeah. Could I ask you to do us a huge favor, man?
Sure.
Could you say, this is Brian Forrester from Hidden Inca Tours, You're listening to freethinkradio.com.
Okay. This is Brian Forster of hiddeninkatruas.com on freethinkradio.com in beautiful Ontario, Canada.
Thank you.
Proud to not be part of any other country. Proud to be true north and free.
Yeah. All right, thanks, man. No, I want to thank you for coming on. Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
I know you got tons of information. You're always out there. You're always, you know, playing around. And the things that me and Nelson would give anything to be playing around in. So
yeah.
Keep up the great work. Thanks for coming to join us here.
Keep posting images. I'm happy to have you at any time if you want to do it again, any time. If you write any new books, keep in touch. Drop me a line. I got you on Facebook, so.
I'm going to be actually staying at David Childress's house. Not that I'm name dropping, but I guess I am, next month, so I'll mention him to you guys.
Please do.
And then also, once he and I, you know, write our book together, maybe, you know, I can convince him that, you know, the two of us should get on your show and discuss it.
Yeah, so excellent.
That would be excellent.
I'm going to do a little bit of plug for the next shows coming up. We got the UFO Hour with Blings coming up next. After that, we got Hardcore Harry Link with Death to the NWO. And then after that, we have your show. Call in. Make it your show. I know I'm sure a lot of people out there got questions they'd love to answer, or love answered. Me and Nelson will do our best tonight to do that. So, again, thanks a lot, Brian, for coming on. This is the True North Hour. Nelson, you got anything you want to say?
No, just want to thank Brian again very much. I'll continue to drop his websites wherever I'm at. I think it's very good book. Everybody should look into buying one of his books anyway, because the information, you won't find it on Zahi's. Not going to give you the info that Brian will give you.
Not when he's behind bars.
No doubt.
And have you noticed the explosion of information coming out since that happened?
Oh, yeah.
That's what I figured after Mubarak, I figured that they were getting influx.
Also, guys, if you are planning a trip to Peru, which, I mean, I'd love to, look this guy up. I checked it out. It's fairly reasonable prices for a tour of things that no one else is going to take you to see. I'd do it in a heartbeat if I had the means to do so, and if I ever do get the means, we will be meeting in person.
That's my pleasure, guys.
Awesome. So,
special discounts for Canadians.
Oh, awesome. You heard it here on True North.
Yeah, all right. I'm Canadian, too.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks for listening to True North. Back on Monday. Same time, same place. I guess that takes us out. Take it out, Blinks.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Peace.